Hey everyone, welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, December 14th, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. I want to thank Elena Scott, Phil Tebear, Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell for supporting the show this week. If you'd like to support Talk Nerdy to help keep it 100% free to download, you can visit patreon.com/talknerdy or karasantamaria.com to see how. And don't forget, if you visit the Talk Nerdy store at karasantamaria.com, you can use the offer code NERDYHOLIDAY. Once again, that's NERDYHOLIDAY to save 15% off your order and get a free gift from one of our sponsors. All right, guys, I am excited to welcome Jason Goldman back to the podcast. He is a cognitive scientist and science writer who focuses on urban wildlife and ecology. Here he is, Dr. Jason Goldman. What's up, Jason?
Are we recording already?
Now we are. What's up, Jason?
Not too much.
I think that's how I should start them all. Don't need to be too official.
I mean, if you want to stay with the pattern, then you have to start them all with, thank you so much for sitting in LA traffic and sitting with me in my recording studio / kitchen.
You sound just like me.
I have listened to enough of the episodes.
Yeah. You know, it's pretty common that people, when I have certain female guests, that I'll get feedback from people like, I can't tell your voices apart.
I can, but I also know most of your guests.
That's true. And also, it's probably pretty easy to tell our voices apart.
I hope so.
So we just ate steak together. It was a bonding experience.
We did. My steak came chopped up into little pieces.
With peppers and onions, and it smelled so good.
And pasta.
That's actually really smart. What is that called? It was
like
called something.
The dish?
Yeah, it was called like...
Sinatra? Steak Sinatra?
Steak Sinatra. I think they just made that up.
I'm sure they did.
Yeah.
Like some things with names are a thing, like Steak Diane.
Is that a thing?
Yeah. I couldn't tell you what it is, but it's a thing.
I know that like there's like chicken...
Cordon Bleu.
That's a thing.
Chicken.
Parmesan.
Parmesan. Yes, those are not like first
piccata?
Names.
Piccata?
Piccata is a thing.
But none of those are people's
not,
names.
Those are not names, no.
Oh. I'm looking
but
up.
Steak Diane is a thing.
I'm looking up steak. Oh, Milanese. That's not a name.
No,
either.
That's a place. Milan. That's where true. That's where like the handbags come from.
Hey, when you put steak into the Google search bar, it says Steak and Shake, Steak Marinade, Steak Diane, Steakhouse,
See?
And steak recipes. I'm looking up Steak Sinatra now. Oh, it is a thing.
But is it a thing that's on like the website of the restaurant we went to?
No. It's everywhere.
Really?
Yeah. It's like our menu. We have a Steak Sinatra, best Steak Sinatra. And then there's recipes for Steak Sinatra.
You think it's like a dish that Frank Sinatra invented at some restaurant somewhere and then they started putting on their menu?
Or it's one of those things where like somebody was like, we really like Frank Sinatra, so we're going to name the steak after him. And then people were like, that's a pretty good dish. And then other restaurants started making it. Let me see. Ooh, it's got ketchup in it.
No.
Yeah.
Not the one I had. Maybe in like the sauce? No. I mean, there was
oh,
not.
But you know, this is like some random person's
like
recipe.
From some blog.
Like, yeah, something dot
oh,
something.
Well, if it's things you have at home, then sure.
Cooking.food. No, that's not what it really is called. Okay. Should we keep talking about Steak Sinatra? Let's see. Yeah, the weird thing is there's no wiki page for it. No, don't install updates. Later.
I think one of my favorite random words that is attached to a food dish
mm-hmm.
that's not like the way Sinatra is not a description of food.
Yeah.
Is casino, like Clams Casino.
That's a thing?
Yes. I once again could not tell you what it is, but I know I've seen it on 1,000 menus.
I'm looking it up. Oh, there it is. When you put in clams, plural, right. Clams Casino is the first thing you see. Clammy Clams.
See,
this one has a wiki page, though, so it's going to tell us what it is. It's a clam on the half shell dish with breadcrumbs and bacon.
That sounds tasty.
And it originated in Rhode Island.
At a casino?
Doesn't say.
Maybe it's like extravagant because of all the bacon.
It was. Yeah, wait. According to legend, the recipe for Clams Casino was originally developed in 1917 in the little casino in Narragansett.
Yeah, I don't know how to say like East... like East New Coast England
words. Yeah, because they're all like Native American words. They're hard to pronounce.
The first time I went to Long Island was just a couple summers ago for a wedding.
Long Island's especially
difficult.
I was
like in the taxi or whatever, the super shuttle from the airport going out like to wherever we went.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, I felt like I was in a foreign country.
Yeah, no, it is. It's like, and you can't say, you're like that exit.
Right, like I'm supposed to be able to read these words. These are English letters.
Yeah, but it's like Q-U-R-R-R-R-R. Yeah, you know, there's like all these weird, I don't know. It's not easy. It's like being in Hawaii.
Yeah, but I feel like there's less vowels and more consonants.
I think so. But also in the Hawaiian language, aren't there only like 7 letters or 11?
I'm pretty sure there's more than that.
No, I think it's like a really...
I don't think it's 7.
Yeah, you're right.
I'm willing to believe it's like 17.
I think it's less than 17. Let me see. How many letters, this is all we're going to do on this podcast, are in the Hawaiian alphabet? And what are they? Okay. It should not be mistaken for the Hawaiian language nor a dialect of English. The Hawaiian alphabet has 13 letters.
That's more than 7.
I know, but it's still not that many.
Nearly twice as many
but
as 7.
But it's less than 17.
That is... I think it's probably as close to 17 as it is to 7. Without doing the mental math in my head, because that's not something
that's
I can do.
Really difficult, and it's late at night.
Yeah.
But it is interesting. That's, I think, why Hawaiian...
In fact, 13 is closer to 17. I just counted them on my finger.
But that's why Hawaiian like looks funny, because a lot of times...
Because they're all vowels.
And it's all just
the
combination
all the
of... A, B, D, E, H, I... K-L-M-N-O-P-R-T-U-V-W. Citation needed. Wiki. Okay.
Have you made your donation to the Wikimedia Foundation?
I haven't.
Every time I open that page this week, it's asking me for...
Looks like they closed that because that's not the case on Wiki right now. I haven't opened Wikipedia this week.
Wow.
This is the first time. Wow. We do rely too heavily on Wikipedia, I think. Not like you personally, like we as a culture.
No, I use it quite a bit.
I do too.
It's a
jumping off point. It would never be a source
it's a
or a citation.
Tool, for quick fact checks.
Yeah.
I would never like use it as a source for a piece I was writing.
No.
At least not. I mean, sometimes I'd use it to go and track down original sources.
Mm-hmm. That's true because. Because
I mean, it has a really good citation like.
And well curated pages have a lot of. You're right. Of
right.
citations.
So sometimes if there's like a topic that I've never written about and I don't necessarily have the background,
mm-hmm.
Like going through the references listed on a Wikipedia page gives you at least sort of a basic rundown.
On the Skeptic's Guide podcast, I do a segment about words, and usually what I'll do is I'll read the definition across like 20 online dictionaries just to see where all the variances are.
Huh.
And then I will look up the etymology across maybe 4 or 5 places. But sometimes when I'm like working with words that have a lot of different definitions or are contextually bound to different types of science, I will actually go to their wiki page because I find that they have better etymology on the wiki page.
I believe that.
Yeah, like it'll be like this word was first used in this context, and then I can click through and actually see like a Google Books result and read the words of the person who first made the word up, which is great. It's nice in science when you can actually find words that were literally invented. Yeah, because then you can really track them down. And then otherwise you have to go through all of the iterations of the Latin or the Greek, which is usually what it is. Yeah, words are fun.
Yeah.
I read them sometimes in books.
Sometimes.
I've been really bad at
it. You produce them quite a bit with
your
mouth
words.
Parts.
Yeah. I've not been reading a lot lately. It's pretty terrible.
Are
you on a book right now?
I read for a living, right? Like, I spend my whole day reading.
Yeah.
So, like, when the day is over, usually I just want to sit on my couch and watch the TV.
Watch Netflix.
Yes.
Oh, what are you watching right now?
But, well, so let me finish answering the book question.
What? Shiny.
The last book I read that was not, like, for work.
Uh-huh.
When I travel, I have time to read.
Yeah.
And I like to read books that take place in the places that I am.
Oh, that's smart.
So the last time I like had a serious trip was I was on a family vacation. I read The Martian, but before that,
you guys went to Mars?
No, I read that on a family like cruise. No, I just read that because I wanted to read that.
So good.
That does not fit my rule of reading books that take places in the places where I am. No, when I was in the jungle in Peru with Aaron and Jeff, who you've both had on the podcast,
yeah.
I read a book called State of Change, which takes place in the Amazon. which is pretty cool.
Is it about the gold problems?
No. It's fiction.
Oh, it's fiction. It's fiction. Oh, okay.
But it's about researchers who are like trying to develop this drug from this tree in the Amazon, and there's this like indigenous tribe, and there's like a mystery. I don't want to spoil it for people who might want. It's by, oh man.
I'll look it up.
I want to say it's like, you're going to look it up, and I hope I say it right. I feel like it's Ann Patchett.
Okay. He says Ann Patchett.
The cover is green and has white flowers.
This is called State of Change, Forgotten Landscapes of California.
No, that's not it.
There are multiple state of, okay. State of Change book.
Yes.
Also Forgotten Landscapes of California.
No.
Information Apology.
Look up like State of Change fiction.
Oh my God, this is so annoying. Book review. I'm pretty sure I think there was a more recent book called State of Change about the Forgotten Landscapes of California.
It's not brand new.
State of Change. Oh my fucking God, it's all this California steel by... Are you sure it's called State of Change?
No, but I'm pretty
State
sure.
State of Change. Amazon is what I'm looking at.
Yeah, just go to Amazon and type it in.
Go to Amazon? No, I'm looking up like the Amazon rainforest.
Yeah, no, I'm saying go to Amazon.com and type in State of Change Amazon.
Oh my God, this is so confusing. Okay, let's see. Amazon.com.
If this is not the title of the book.
It's not the title of the book. I can almost guarantee
you. Man, what? It was a really good book, too.
State of Change, fiction.
State of Play? No, State of Play was a movie.
Amazon. What do you think her name was? Ann Patchett?
I could be just making this up.
This is awesome. There's neither an Ann Patchett nor a State of Change book on Amazon.
There's got to be something. It's got to at least be, whatever it really is, it's got to at least be related.
Okay, I'm gonna find out. So book about, what's it about? About
medicine.
Pharma?
Yeah, okay. Pharmaceutical development.
Pharmaceutical development. This is how to use the Google.
Amazon rainforest.
In the Amazon rainforest. People want to know about this
State
book.
Of Change.
State of Wonder.
Oh.
But hey.
Okay, I was not that far off.
And it's by Ann Patchett.
Okay, so I get like a B+.
You get a solid C.
State of Wonder.
It's called State of Wonder, a novel.
Yes, that's it. That is what it was called.
It looks
and,
good.
And one of the editions has like a bright neon green cover.
This cover is blue with pretty flowers and stuff.
Yeah, so,
and butterflies.
So there are flowers and butterflies as well.
Yeah,
part of the
no,
story.
This actually looks good and it has a really high rating on
Amazon.
Yeah,
no, it was good. I just couldn't remember the title apparently.
So you like to, when you're not reading, because so you write science and oftentimes you focus on like environment, ecology, urban wildlife, that kind of stuff. Yeah. But you have a broad beat. And so you have to read a lot of like periodicals and journal articles and sometimes whole books. I remember one time being in your car and you had a book in the back seat about bison contraception.
Wildlife contraception. Yeah. Yeah. I think I still have that book.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I was working on a piece about the bison contraception program on Catalina Island.
I love that. And we're going to talk about another fun thing you did on Catalina. But you like to read fiction generally when you're not working.
I try to. I read a lot of nonfiction, mm-hmm. and I feel like as a person and also as a writer, I ought to be reading fiction.
Stories, yeah.
Right? So I end up reading like fiction that's like about the same kinds of things I like read about when I read nonfiction. That's just kind of where I'm drawn, where like scientists are the protagonists and that kind of thing.
I am so bad about only reading nonfiction. It's terrible.
So like, but like it's an effort. I try to make an effort to read fiction.
Yeah, and the truth is, once you do start reading fiction, you're like, this is awesome.
If it's well done, yeah.
And they're page turners, and you actually can't wait to read the next chapter. It's like a good TV show.
So, like, The Martian, I was on this, like, 10-day cruise with my family.
Uh-huh.
And, like, I could have finished it in 2 nights, probably. But I forced myself to read it slowly, like, to only read, like, a few chapters a night.
Yeah.
So that it would last the entire 10 days.
Which is funny, because with nonfiction, I often will only read a chapter a night, depending on how long they are. But with fiction, you find yourself being like, I'm so tired, but I have to read one more chapter.
Well, because nonfiction usually, at least the kinds of books probably that you and I read, are a little bit heavier and denser, and, like, you have to, they're a little more thinky.
They are. Right now, though, I'm reading a history
book. Like, they take more mental energy, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Especially with, like, the hardcore science. Like, so I finished some really good books lately that were very like deathy. Like it was a lot of like morbid stuff. And I still have more deathy books on my bedside. And I was like, I can't read like 3 death books in a row. So I was trying to figure out what to read next. And I'm really looking forward to, so I bought The Joy of X, which I think will be fun, but it's mathy. And I every night that I go to read, I'm like way too tired to think about math.
I read a math book once. No, when I was like, I took one science journalism class in college or grad school, actually. We had to like read a bunch of books, right? A bunch of science books. It was by Keith Devlin. I'm positive this time. I don't remember what it was called. But it was, maybe it was called like The Number Sense or something. No, no, that's someone else's book.
Keith Devlin. I'm also looking that up.
I'm 99.5% sure. This was years ago in grad school.
Keith Devlin on Amazon. He's at Stanford.
Sure.
And he
writes about math.
Could be a different. Yeah, he's a British mathematician at Stanford and popular science writer.
Okay.
And he wrote a book called, he's written a lot of books.
Because like when I was younger, well, it's actually probably still the case now. Like I did not think I was good at math when I was back to like the third grade or something. Even though I was in like the highest math classes and like I was in AP calculus and stuff. And
Feeling though. I think a lot of people feel like they're not good at math.
Right. But I always liked thinking about numbers.
Did you read The Numbers Behind Numbers?
No.
Oh. Oh, like the show Numbers. He wrote that.
Oh.
The Millennium Problems, Introduction to Mathematical Thinking.
Could be.
The Language of Mathematics.
Maybe. I don't know.
The Unfinished Game.
Nope.
The Math Gene.
Nope.
The Math Instinct. Oh my God. He has written so
many. I feel like it had numbers in the title. But
the Computer as Crucible.
No. No. It was.
The Joy of Sets. That's a really funny
book. That sounds like
a
textbook.
Yeah. He's written textbooks. It looks like Life in the Numbers.
I think I feel like it was about numbers. I don't remember. It was years
ago. At least, oh my God, he's written like 500 books.
Okay,
this guy is so prolific.
It was a book about math and numbers.
Yeah,
and it was good. So, you know, if people listening want to read about math, they should read books by Keith Devlin.
But also, I know the Steve Strogatz book, The Joy of X, is like a really good book. It comes very highly recommended. So I'm looking forward to it because it's on my bedside. And also, The Meaning of Human Existence by E.O. Wilson is on my bedside. And I'm so looking forward to reading it. But I brought it with me
That's a pretty audacious title.
I know. And I brought it with me on a shoot and like started the first chapter. And people were like, really? The Meaning of Human Existence? I was like, shut up. But what I'm actually reading right now is a book that I got back when I was working at Take Part Live. I interviewed the author. This is like one of the hugest perks about working on a TV show where you get to interview people all the time is you always get their books for free.
Yeah, I get that too. I'm not on a TV show.
That's true. It's also a perk of being a journalist, isn't it? So I'm reading this fascinating book called Operation Paperclip. Have you heard of this?
No.
So Operation Paperclip was the code name that they used for... Right after World War II, U.S. intelligence extracted a bunch of Nazi scientists and brought them to the U.S.
I've heard of this.
Yeah, and like used them to develop all sorts
like
of...
Like the Manhattan Project.
No. Yeah, there's yes. like... But there was like a lot of Nazi scientists living in the U.S. with like basically not really new identities, but they were sort of like made
washed,
safe.
Like
yeah.
wandered.
And it's crazy. So I'm reading it right now and all the Nazis are still in Germany. But it's basically all about this insane thing that the U.S. government did and what kind of science came out of it and how, you know, like that sort of thing where like you feel weird about it because like some good science actually came out of it.
Yeah.
But also some of the really horrible science that was being done in Nazi Germany before we extracted them. So it's a good book, but it's like a gazillion pages too. It's hard and it's thick and it's got a giant swastika on the cover, so I can't really bring it out in public.
Yeah, no,
doesn't look good. Because also people are like Operation Paperclip.
Yeah,
it's like the like banal kind of code name.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I did just finish the TV show. I saw that Zoo, the first season, wound up on Netflix.
Was it any good?
Because
you're a zoo guy. You're interested in zoos.
So do you know the premise of this story?
No, but I remember it was like eyes that look like cat eyes on the poster.
So there's something about eyes, yes.
Okay.
It was a James Patterson book
that
got turned into a TV show.
Okay. Right?
And I never like got around to watching while it was airing, but the first season just popped up on Netflix. And I was like, I'll watch the pilot. And then I ended up finishing the season. It's only like 10 or 13 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
13 episodes, I think. Which, you know, I can power through in like 3 nights.
Yeah.
And at first I was like, this is an interesting story and there's interesting characters, but if you know the first thing about animal behavior, like, you just can't. I couldn't.
It's like a lawyer watching a John
right.
Grisham
or
movie.
Or like a doctor or nurse watching a house or
yeah.
something, right? But like I tried really hard. Like, I didn't just try hard to like it, but I tried hard to get over the whole, like, this isn't science, it's not meant to be science, like, this is about telling a story. thing. Mm-hmm. Because I believe that, right? I believe that to be the case. It's not about the science. But it was interesting. It's interesting to watch, thinking about where our society, or at least in our country, is about thinking about animals and our relationship to them.
Yeah.
But it was, it definitely took some, like, I had to really try hard to suspend my disbelief.
What were some of the themes? I mean, without talking about the plot lines, like, were the themes?
So the idea, let me see if I can
not spoil anything.
Yeah, I mean, what's the statute of limitation on spoilers? Like, if once it's on Netflix and it's already aired.
It's really tough, I'm telling you. Like, because some people get mad if you spoil, like, Breaking Bad.
Or, like, Star Wars.
Oh, that pisses me off.
Like, I think it's enough time has passed where if you don't know the, like, twists.
Yeah.
Like, who cares?
Could be. I'm watching Mr. Robot right now, and that's been out for a long time,
I've
think.
I've never seen that.
And it's, like, got a very obvious twist that I'm not going to say out loud, but, like, it's one of those ones where they kind of set it up throughout the season. I'm only halfway through the first season, okay. But it's pretty obvious by episode two what, like, the major twist is. Right. So I'm hoping there's a second twist that makes me go, oh, good, because I didn't see that coming.
Right. So the basic idea behind Zoo is that humans, for as long as we've existed, have made life really hard for animals.
Mm-hmm.
And now the animals are fighting back.
Oh, it's like Planet of the Apes.
A little bit.
Okay.
Less
apes?
Yeah. Well, and less, like, more earthly.
Okay.
Like, more, you know, set in, like, now.
But, gotcha. But the ape, well, the new Planet of the Apes are set now.
Right, that's true. Yeah. That's true.
But in the Planet of the Apes, they can, like, talk and shit. Can the zoo animals talk?
They can't speak in English. But, like, every episode, basically, there's like there's like a narrative arc, but it's also like the villain of the week, right? The puzzle of the week, and it's like in this week, the lions have this new ability, and then next week it's like, oh, these birds have this new ability that they didn't have before. And while they can't talk, many of those abilities are related to communication.
I see. And was there some sort of like nuclear disaster that caused this?
Or does it? Yeah, I think at least once you watch the pilot. Yeah, so I'm going to just assume that if information is divulged in the pilot, it's safe. It's not a spoiler.
Oh, for sure, because pilots always suck anyway, so you have to usually
suffer.
It has
to do with,
them.
Like, big business.
I see.
Yeah, there's, like, a big, you know, evil corporation involved.
Doing, like, research in the back room.
That's, like, you know, putting weird things into their chemicals that are getting sprayed over all of the world's forests and plains and fields, and then these animals eat them, and then they get, you know.
It's like the most obvious sci-fi device. Yeah, exactly. Because that's kind of Planet of the Apes too. The new ones.
The new ones. Yeah, which was research.
It was like Alzheimer's drug or something.
Right.
Yeah. That's kind of interesting though.
Yeah, I mean, the story was good enough to keep me watching it for, you know, 13 hours.
I wonder if you'd like reading it. I don't know about James Patterson.
I don't know.
I've never read any of his books.
Neither.
But he's like Stephen King in that way. He just like churns them out.
Yeah.
God, I
wish.
Yeah, but
you can almost.
Don't you wish you had that ability?
You could almost like tell. Like towards the end of the, I mean, not having read the book, I don't know anything about what's in it, but just based on the, like watching the tone of the show, like around about episode 12, it's almost like there's a shift in tone and you can tell where the source material ends and where a writer's room full of people were like, okay, what comes next? Because they have no more story, right? I assume. Because like, I assume at the end of the book, like everything is happy, like there's a happy ending and it's not like, even
horrible.
More bad things happen.
Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
You never know. But
but it's like there's this, like, a certain tone throughout the first like 11 and a half hours. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden there's like fighter pilots and like soldiers. And like, and you just know that some writer's room somewhere were like, can we do it now? Can we put in some fire planes now?
Yeah.
So.
Or the network was like, I think we need some blood. Some like
there's plenty of blood, there's plenty of carnage.
Oh, that's good.
Imagine a world full of animals that have had it with like being mistreated by humans.
Oh, legit. So lions are like ripping people's throats out.
Yes.
Shit. Okay. That's
I mean, it's network television, so you don't quite see it.
Yeah.
You kind of see the approach and then you see the aftermath.
I've been surprised though. So I'm watching Mr. Robot and I've been surprised. This is, I think, a USA show. So it's like kind of network. It's like one of those in-between networks. And they say shit. They say fuck all the time. They don't bleep it. They just kind of, you know, pop the name out or pop the word out. You know what
it's
I'm talking about?
Like the vowel. So
it's like, yeah, it's like silent. It's really graphic. Like more and more, I think TV's getting really good. We're kind of in a golden era of TV.
In some ways,
I've been
yeah.
watching Fargo, which is on FX, which is fucking horrifically bloody.
Yeah, that's amazing.
That's
cable. Though.
Yeah,
that's
that
not
is cable.
CBS. I think it was CBS, NBC. It was one,
gotcha.
Of the, one of the networks.
And then, of course, I'm obsessed with The Nick. I've been watching that, and that's like full, like that's subscription cable. Yeah, so yeah. It's really crazy. I think it's on Cinemax. Have you watched The Nick?
No,
it's really good.
No, I don't get Cinemax. I don't think.
I think if you get HBO, it just kind of comes
HBO
with
on
it.
Showtime.
You should check. Cinemax is one Cinemax? Of those like sleeper channels that you don't realize you have. But it's so good. It's probably all on demand.
Yeah.
Do you guys watch The Nick? You should tweet me if you watch The Nick. Because the last episode I saw was crazy.
And you should tweet me if you watch Zoo.
Yeah. Yeah. Tweet Jason and be like, I like the Zoo. I like Zoo. I liked it when the giraffe ate the lion.
Yeah. But so,
that probably
so
never happened.
I mean, I guess my main point was that it's like, I feel like in some ways, you know, we've lived through like Blackfish.
Yeah.
And we had like the week of Seas of the Lion last year. Like, we're starting to ask some interesting questions, I feel like, as a society about how animals fit into our lives, even if we're not ready to give up eating our cheeseburgers, right?
No, but that's true. I mean, it's not just like the like what people think of like the extremist left-wing activists
right.
anymore. There's like major societal shifts
right.
that are
and
happening.
And the interesting thing in the show is that they put these characters who like, you know, they put these characters in these situations who maybe they agree on 95% of things, but one is like a crazy like eco-terrorist.
Yeah.
And one is like a kind of a reasonable, normal person who believes that animals should be treated properly and with mm-hmm. respect. And sort of seeing where those tensions rise. I think living and working in the space that I do, that was interesting for me to watch and to see those kinds of questions being asked on network television.
Yeah, it's kind of like there's sort of a continuum in which I think somewhere in the middle you have people who are concerned about animal welfare. And then if you go like more to the left, I don't know if left and right really persists here, but like
right.
if you go to one side, you get into like the animal rights activists
right.
into, and then keep going, you get into that eco-terrorism. But you go to the other side, you kind of get the like animals aren't people.
Right.
And I think there's a lot of like religious influence in that a little bit. We're somehow yeah. special. We're not like people who don't believe that we evolved
right.
Alongside or that somehow like because God made us in his own image, then we somehow have these like special abilities and animals aren't sentient. I mean, they're not, but I mean, they are. Just because they can't talk doesn't mean they're not sentient. They can think.
Right.
But yeah, I think there is still, but that feels like it's a shrinking group of people who kind of have this like, well, I have command over the earth. I'm a human.
Yeah.
So I have a special privilege.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if it's shrinking or growing. I just think people, I mean, and this is completely anecdotal. I have no like evidence to mm-hmm. suggest this except for trying to watch these trends.
Nor did I, by the way.
But I feel like in some ways people are starting to realize that animals are individuals, like
yeah.
with goals and desires, you know, in a way where like we're completely comfortable with thinking of like our dog
mm-hmm.
or our pet cat or something as an individual with a personality and individual motivations to pursue whatever the goals there are. I feel like people are starting to think about giraffes that way, you know, or
yeah, wild animals,
or lions, right? Wild animals, wildlife, and you know, I think it's going to be a while before people are willing to think about things like rattlesnakes
yeah.
as individuals.
Or even, unfortunately,
you know, or insects.
Cows and pigs
cows,
and chickens.
Yeah. yeah.
But it's true. Also, this like an empathic viewpoint that like, and this is what the activists have always been pushing for, right? But this empathic viewpoint of like animals suffer.
Yeah.
And they
or they can.
Feel things. Yeah, they can. And they can feel... I don't know if like loneliness is the right word, but when they're impoverished in their environments,
yeah.
that affects them, that it affects their brains and it affects their behavior, you know, when they don't have
yeah. social isolation.
Exactly. Social isolation. And also just,
for a species that is social, right? Like it's.
Yeah. Not just the social isolation, but also the, like we know from being, you know, in neuroscience courses, like, rat studies where
right.
you put
impoverished
it
in environments and enriched environments.
Totally. Like just having toys and having food available
yeah.
and having things to do.
And you know the crazy thing? Like you know, I'm a fan of zoos, a good ethical accredited zoos and
zoos that have a conservation and education component.
Right. But in our country, so like, you know, when you do animal research, as I did in grad school, like you have to go through and learn about like the history of animal research in our country as part of your like certification. And something that I learned that I did not know previously is that in the U.S., there are certain animals for whom you are required to give enrichment. Right. Now, zoos give enrichment to like everything.
Yeah. Except maybe insects. Some do.
Some do. And, and you know, different species have different kinds of requirements and you enrich them in different ways.
Yeah.
And what might not, like, it might not be obvious to the casual zoo goer what counts as enrichment for a given species, right?
Sure. But maybe even having it under the right light temperature or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Or even just like different feeding, like different foods in different days and.
Yeah. Feeding it alive.
Unpredictability.
A live thing instead of a dead thing. Or...
Right. Which is also controversial.
Interesting.
In the U.S., unless the laws have changed, and I don't think they have, the only species which you are required to enrich, whether you're a zoo or a laboratory or something, are primates and domestic dogs.
Not cats?
I don't think so.
And also not, like, elephants?
I don't think so.
That sucks.
I mean, elephants certainly do get enrichment.
Elephants need it. But elephants sometimes don't, you know, and that's been, like...
Well, then the question is, what is sufficient?
A big controversy. Also, elephants have historically been like really abused in the like circus kind of side of things.
Yeah, I mean, ever since, I mean, going back to like Roman, Egyptian, you know, kingdoms, like elephants were captured in Africa, usually the smaller forest elephants, because they're easier to capture, and using these menageries, and also in like the military.
Yeah, I watched this documentary. I can't remember if it was on HBO. Called like an apology. Yeah.
It's
fuck
like
with your mic.
Sinking.
It's sinking here. Tighten that part. My mics are so ghetto. No, other way. Righty tighty. Yeah, you're just doing it from across the there you go. My mics are so ghetto. I know I keep
it's
saying
just the stand.
Buy new mic. Well, the stands are ghetto too. Everything's gonna be improved.
I have the same stands.
New house, everything will be improved. No, I want to get those ones that are like the scissor stands.
Yeah.
You know, so you can like just barely touch it and move it wherever. And of course the mics will be condenser mics.
Yeah, those I have. Yeah. But I have the same stands.
Once I have like soundproofing and stuff. But yeah, I watched this this documentary, I think an apology for elephants. Huh. And I'm not sure again how activist-y, you know, it's like I always grain of salt everything, like who made it, what was there, whatever. But I mean, it was mostly footage that you could see with your eyes, and it was about basically the history of how they've been treated in circuses.
Yeah.
And what it takes to train an elephant to do all these things that it doesn't do in the wild. And it's fucking horrible. Like the tool that they use.
Oh, the bull hook.
Yeah.
Which is like, at least in ethical zoos, is no longer.
Yeah, it's horrific. And so, yeah, they also talked about the improvements to like that some zoos are using for how they feed is basically to or give medicine or do things is basically ask the elephant to come to. They never can do anything to an elephant with an elephant unless the elephant first approaches them.
Yeah.
And they also do everything between some sort of fencing.
Protected contact.
Yeah. And so that it's like a new kind of interesting way to interact, which is interesting. I don't know. It was a good doc. It was sad.
Yeah.
Kind of short. Yeah. And sad. I watch a lot of sad documentaries.
You watch a lot of documentaries in general.
I do watch a lot of documentaries. I think that's my way to read books fast.
Mm,
you know, it's like, because I'm a super slow reader, which I think translates to me being a super slow writer.
Huh.
I'm just one of those people who, like reading comprehension is so important to me, and I don't have the capacity to absorb things if I fly through them.
Yeah.
And so I read really fucking slow. But with a documentary, I feel like I can get a really interesting, timely story. I don't know. I'm just really obsessed with Frontline. So
yeah.
Like every time there's a new Frontline, it comes out. Every time there's anything like an issue.
The problem with Frontline is all I ever think about is the stuff you give to dogs.
Frontline, the flea and tick medicine.
Yes.
That's funny. That's not the association
it's
I have.
When I hear Frontline, I just see the box.
I remember when Frontline started following me back on Twitter and I like had a
the
huge
TV show.
Yeah, that TV show. I think because I tweet about it so much.
Yeah, see, for me, when I watch TV, it's like candy. Like it's what I do at the end of the day to turn my brain off.
And in some ways we're the opposite. I do that too with like Netflix show, you know, but at the same time, like TV for me is a write off. The way that like all your magazine subscriptions are a write off, like my cable is a write off because I'm on TV. Yeah. And so I have to know what else is going on
That's true.
I have to see how other shows are doing it. So for me, TV is kind of 50-50 enjoyment and research. And yeah, those kinds of doc shows. Also, Frontline is not even, I mean, it is TV, it's on PBS, but you don't even have to have TV to watch Frontline. You can watch it on Apple TV. You can watch it on your computer. Oh my God. And it's so good. I very firmly feel like it's kind of the last bastion of like legitimate, sort of unbiased, deep investigative reporting on TV. And I use Frontline as a model in all of the work that I do at SoCal Connected. Not to say by any stretch that I can achieve anything close to it, because they do have way more resources and a much longer timeline. But I always think about that. I'm always like, what would they do on Frontline? Yeah, because to me, it's just the echelon. It sets the standard.
Yeah.
Do you have anything like that in your science writing? Like any sort of periodicals or any books or anything that you're like, oh, how would so-and-so do it? Or, you know, what's the standard for you?
I don't know. There's a lot of individual writers that I pay attention to, you know, to see what they're doing and how they're doing it and where they're doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, the dream, like if you write about wildlife, the dream is still National Geographic magazine, right?
Yeah.
And it continues to be, you know, despite some of their organization, their reorganization.
Yeah. I'm interested in how that is playing out, right? Because Murdoch has owned the network for a long time.
Yeah.
And the network has been like linked to Fox for a long time now. And the magazine also, I think, had some sort of share in it. But I think the idea is that now it's equally run by Murdoch and by the National Geographic Society, when before the Society ran it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know all the like details. I know that in terms of the channels, at least my understanding, based on my conversations with the executives there.
Yeah.
Is the networks are owned by Fox. They are Fox properties.
Yeah, and that's not new.
Right. But there's they get like editorial oversight from the Society, and like certain kinds of fact checking and decisions are made by the Society in terms of like the content.
Yeah.
Which is good. You know, it's good to do that.
I think the issue with the magazine is that historically the magazine was only the Society's purview, and now there's another show. And it's funny because people get really pissy about it, right? They're like, oh, I can't believe it, and it's going to change everything. It's like, then fucking buy the magazine.
Right.
Like,
right. There's a reason. Circulation was up, and this would not be an issue.
Exactly. Like, they needed help. They couldn't, because it, like you said, it sets a standard. It's expensive to do those kinds of photo spreads. It's expensive to do that kind of reporting that's required to tell a story that's happening in like a deep forest in, you know, Africa, or, you know, it's hard to get to these places and to bring all of the equipment that you need. And it's not cheap.
Yeah. And if you're, you know, writing these Nat Geo features, let's say you're a contributing writer and you're writing, you know, maybe two or three features a year for them.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, that's your job.
Like,
you'll
what
do
you're
a little
doing.
Bit, you'll do some more freelancing, but like that takes time.
Yeah.
And money, you know, if you're only going to do a few features a year, then they need to pay well if you're going to make a living.
Is that something that you, because you're a freelance writer, but you have like, you have knives in a lot of different fires, right? Like, you're an academic first who studied animal behavior.
I did.
When you left that, and kind of animal cognition, right? More than behavior.
Yeah.
And when you left that, you were kind of interested in looking at zoos and in looking at, I don't know, like, what would you say, like, the...
Well, yeah. So, I mean, so for one thing, I left academia to be a science communicator full-time, right? Like, I realized that I liked writing about other people's research more than doing my own.
Yeah.
But I realized I just tried to scratch my ear, like, through the headphones.
you're like, my ear is so plasticky.
I realized, like, while I was doing this research in animal cognition, many researchers who study animals, who study animal cognition, use animals as a model, right, to understand people. They're not necessarily interested in the animal for its own sake. I was interested in both ways. But I started to think that, like, if you really want to understand this animal's mind, you need to understand something about its ecology, right? Like the environment in which that mind evolved and continues to exist.
Instead of what we often do in the lab and what even you were doing in the lab, which was basically...
controlling everything.
Yeah, raise it in a cage, control everything else so that you can really understand these
but even if you are
specific variables.
Controlling everything, it's still good to understand something of the ecology in which the animal...
came from.
Evolved,
yeah.
Right? And that's done, like, in certain parts of animal cognition research. I think there's more of that. Like, in great ape research, I think there's more of an attempt to understand what the ecology is, the social ecology, the feeding ecology, how these things build to, like, the mind and the brain and behavior that we see.
And also, I think in, like, what do they call them? Charismatic megafauna. Like, kind of the bigger the animal and the more it captures your imagination, it seems like the more that people have actually dedicated time and resources to understanding.
Sure, but those are not necessarily animal cognition people. Those
I guess that's true. There's more ecologists.
And the evolutionary biologists.
Yeah, because you're not going to study, like, theory of mind in a lion.
Right.
Hard to do in a lab.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. So, and like, they have teeth, you know, like,
exactly.
Like, it's not necessarily safe for the researcher.
Unless or
it's
the
a
lion,
tame, hand-raised lion, but that's, like, not the point.
No, we also saw what happened to those magicians.
Magicians.
Oh, those were tigers.
Siegfried and Roy.
Yeah. Or was it
and
just
they
Roy?
Were hand-raised.
Yeah.
So I started to, that's sort of how I started thinking, why I started to think about, like, ecology and, and that led me to thinking about conservation and all these things. So that's sort of.
But the through line has been writing. Like, you've always been writing.
Yeah, even when I was in grad school.
Even when you were looking into potentially working in other arenas, it was still going to be about communicating.
It's about, when I, at one point I thought I might want to, if I wanted to stay in research, it might make sense to do it like a zoo.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a place where outreach and science communication is explicitly valued.
So even if you had stayed in academia, you would want like 75% of your job to be.
Which is like why I realized, like, I was talking with a researcher about a possible postdoc. And I was like, if I'm going to keep doing research, I want to get out of the lab. I want to get into the field. We came up with this neat study, you know, chasing monkeys through the jungle.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that the reason I wanted to do it was to write about it, not to collect the data.
Gotcha.
And that's a terrible reason to do research, especially when, like, as a writer, as a science writer or science communicator, I can still do that. Like, I'm not chasing the monkeys through the jungle, but I'm chasing researchers who are chasing monkeys.
But also,
the jungle, right?
Sometimes you do have the opportunity to actually go with them and do things like chase the monkeys through the jungle.
Yeah, yeah. I'm chasing the researchers while they're chasing the monkeys.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, so I see. So you're not chasing them later.
Right.
You're chasing them.
So I still like get to have some of those field experiences.
Well, you just had one.
Which is, as far as I'm concerned, one of the, like, I have the best job in the world because I get to.
Yeah, your Instagram's awesome. You're always doing weird shit.
Yeah,
you're always
cool.
Like up really early in like a
when
far
I'm in
away
the
place.
When you're in the field,
yeah.
You are awake when the animals are, which is like dawn.
I wouldn't be good at that job.
You know what? When like I in my real life, like my normal hours, like I start working at like 10 or 10:30 or something.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're in the field, like for one thing, you're up with the sun because you don't have blackout curtains.
True.
And like when you're in the Amazon, like your room has three walls. Like when the sun is up and when the howler monkeys are howling, like you're just awake. But it's not like you're like, you want to roll over and put your pillow over your head. Like you just, what you want to get your boots on and get out into the jungle.
And I'm sure when the sun sets, you're actually legit
exhausted.
Tired. Yeah.
Cause you've been up since like 4 a.m.
Yeah.
And you're like on your feet all day walking around. Right. So
you got to do that in the Amazon, but you also recently just did some cool local field work, right? Like you went to Catalina.
I was at Catalina for a day, fox trapping.
Yeah, because like you posted pictures and then we were all like, oh my God, we're so jealous.
Yeah, I got to hold one, which is super like, the Catalina Island fox, all the island foxes, well, 4 of the 6 subspecies of island fox.
Oh, very exact. Uh-huh.
are federally listed and state listed.
Oh, okay.
You actually, like, if you see one, you can't, like, touch it.
Like, if you're out surfing or something and, a sea lion approaches you,
right.
You physically
like you should
have
not
to,
touch
like,
it.
If
yes.
it jumps into your boat, like,
you
have to leave your boat and let it have your boat.
So that's also, like, the Marine Mammal Protection Act.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
But, so, if you live in Catalina, mm-hmm. let's say, and a fox comes into your backyard, like, you should not touch it, right? You definitely should not feed it.
But you were there with researchers.
But I was there with a researcher, and she was like, I so wanted to ask, but I didn't want to ask because I needed to like retain my professionalism. But she was like, do you want to hold it? And I was like, yes, I do. And she took a few photos with my phone. And then I, like, before I shared them, I was like, can I, like, will I get in trouble?
Yeah.
If I, like, and she said, like, that, you know, it was under the supervision, like everyone who does this work, who handles these animals that are endangered,
mm-hmm.
Or threatened, they get special permits, right?
Yeah.
So I was under her supervision.
Awesome.
So
it was okay.
So I got to cuddle a fox. Yeah.
You got to cuddle a fox, and then you got to share the picture.
Yeah, and I probably didn't have to do this, but when I did share it on Instagram and Facebook and everything, I in the caption I was like, do not do this at home.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's good. Because
the first thing everyone says, and even despite my warnings about like the illegality of it, if you're not, you know, in certain circumstances, like the first thing everyone always says is, I want one. And like, you can't have one.
Yeah, you can't have one, but it's because they're so damn cute.
Yeah.
Which is, and that was a full grown fox, right?
That was, yeah. They evolved on an island.
They look like babies.
They, at adult size, they're about the size of a medium house cat. They're like 12 inches tall.
They're like killer.
About.
Yeah, they're like killer size. And just like killer, like something about these foxes have a little bit of that, what do they call it? Like pedomorphism. Yeah, they kind of look like babies. They're very cute. Maybe it's just because they're small, though. Smaller things tend to be cuter.
Yeah, I mean, they're not domesticated the way that dogs
are. They're not. But they have like island evolution.
Island dwarfism, yeah. There's actually a study that came out a year or two ago that looked at the genetics of these island foxes. So there's eight Channel Islands, right, off the coast of California.
Okay.
And there are foxes on six of them.
I had no idea.
And
Catalina's one of them?
Catalina's one of them, right? So it's one species, the island fox, and there's one subspecies for each of the islands, of the six islands on which they...
Oh, so here in the Channel Islands, this is the only place the island fox exists.
Yes, they're endemic. Okay. Yeah.
All right.
And it's the smallest fox in North America.
Gotcha. They're so fucking cute.
And they, like, they're clearly descended from the mainland gray fox. Mm-hmm. Like, and they did some genetic analyses to figure out approximately when they would have gotten to the islands. And the cool thing about these islands, they're often like referred to as like the Galapagos of North America because there's so much endemism there. There's so many species that are only there and nowhere else. Just so much biodiversity, and like not just terrestrially, but also in the water, right?
I'm looking at pictures of them now. I'm like, I stopped listening. No, I'm kidding.
But the cool thing about these islands is that during the last ice age, they were not connected to the mainland.
Oh.
Which means that the stuff that's there has been there
for a long time,
or it was brought over there by like people or by accident. So these foxes probably came something like 17, between 14 and 17,000 years ago, something like that.
Oh, wow.
Look
at that face.
Or is it 1,400 years ago?
I'll look
Maybe it's, yeah, it's 14 and 17, but it's either 100 or 1,000.
Look at that face for a second.
I held one.
I'm dying. I'm dying.
And so they either came over,
I'm looking
like
up.
By Native Americans lived there, either as like quasi pets or like as a food source.
Okay.
Or there was some like big storm that battered the mainland coast and some gray foxes like rafted over on a tree and found their way to the islands. And then maybe they were moved around by humans. Maybe they moved around on their own.
It says the last glacial period was 110,000 years ago. Oh, to 12,000 years ago. Yeah, you're right. It's 12,000. If it was the last glacial period.
No, I mean when the foxes came there.
Oh, well, I'll look up Catalina foxes or Channel Island foxes.
You can just look up the article I wrote about it.
Yeah, that's what I'll do. Channel Island fox, Jason Goldman.
Yeah, I wrote about it at Hakai. No, that's not how you pronounce it. Hakai.
Hakai.
Hakai
see it right
magazine.
Here. A sacrifice for the Catalina foxes.
Yeah.
Is it going to have that picture of you cuddling the fox in it?
No, they didn't run that one. They bought two of my other photos.
They're beautiful.
Not the one on the top. That is like a stock photo, but
this one here of the researcher holding the fox under her arm.
That's Julie King. She's the director of wildlife and conservation for the Catalina Island Conservancy, something like that.
Okay, where did you talk about?
It's in the second half.
Oh, okay. Foxes first came to six of California's eight Channel Islands between 7,100 and 9,200 years ago.
Okay.
So how they did so is a mystery.
7,000 to 9,000 years ago.
That's a long time ago.
I knew there was a seven in there.
Yeah, somewhere. But that's a really long time ago.
Yeah. Yeah. So they've been there for a long time. And they are the largest native mammalian predator on the island.
Really?
On all the islands.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
They are the characteristic megafauna of that island.
Yeah,
and they're so micro.
In terms of the natives.
And how did they deal with, right? Because you were there for a capture and were they tagging them?
Yeah, they were trapping them for now. So what happened on Catalina is in the early to mid 90s, there was a huge population crash on Catalina of these foxes.
Just of the foxes or of a bunch of animals?
Well, anytime there are humans around, then there's problems, right?
Yeah.
But these foxes in particular got hammered.
Mm-hmm.
They went from something like, I don't know, the specific numbers are in my article, but something like before the crash in like 90 assessment or 94 or something.
1,342.
Okay, I was going to say 1,300.
Yes.
And then afterwards it was down to like 104.
103. You were so close.
Okay.
They know down to the number exactly how many there were.
Well, they can do estimates.
Yeah.
Based on their trapping success, they have algorithms and they can.
That is a big difference. That's a tenfold.
Like 90%. Yeah. Right. They knew that it was because of canine distemper virus.
Oh shit! The same thing that your domestic dog can get.
Domestic dogs can get them. So can Ethiopian wolves. So can African wild dogs. Mm. So can raccoons. A lot of not just canines, right? And at first, you know, people thought, well, it's probably because of all these like tourists and people who live on Avalon with their domestic dogs. But it actually turned out that it was the CDV strain belonged to a raccoon, which are not native to the island.
Shit.
So some raccoon probably stowed away on a boat.
Shit. And also, it's not like you're going to vaccinate a raccoon.
Right.
Like, you can vaccinate your dogs to help protect the spread.
Right.
But...
So yeah, I mean, in any place, invasive species are a problem, but they're really a problem on islands.
Yeah,
and these foxes—they
don't have any defenses.
Had no
them.
Natural immunity, mm-hmm. right? So it just totally wiped them out. They did a captive breeding. They rounded up a bunch of the ones that survived. The way the island is shaped, there's like a very small isthmus mm-hmm. In the middle of it. So some of the ones on the I believe the eastern end like didn't get infected.
There's a very narrow crossing. Okay.
Most of the ones on the western ends got wiped out. So they did a captive breeding program. They re-released them this year or last year's estimate on Catalina. There were like 1,800, 1,700.
Holy shit! So more actually, than before.
Yeah, yeah.
They were a little too successful in their breeding.
No,
program.
No. I mean, you know, who knows what? Like, it's hard to say what like the carrying capacity is because the ecosystem is so changed from whatever it might have once been.
Well, and you'll know after enough time.
Right.
Because if they don't have resources, they'll die.
Right, right. And now they have new problems. I mean, so they continue to be, roadkill continues to be a problem for them. They like cars and like while we were out there trapping, like we would see there was a cruise ship like that was docked there that day.
Mm-hmm.
You could see these tourists whizzing by on their rented golf carts.
Mm.
Cars, vehicles continues to be a problem for them. Right now they're also having a problem with them. Cancer.
Fox cancer.
Yeah, yeah, aww. Ear cancer.
Ear cancer mites. Specifically?
Yeah.
Weird.
Paper just came out this week about it, actually. So foxes are on Catalina. They're on five other islands, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they're only listed as endangered or threatened on four of them.
Okay.
So two of the islands that they're on belong to the military.
Mm-hmm.
And they seem to be doing okay
there. Oh, because there's not a lot of foot traffic.
Right.
Yeah.
But on the northern islands, the three islands that also had serious, like analogous reductions in fox numbers were not because of CDV, but it happened to be around the same time mm-hmm. that they were getting hammered by golden eagles.
Golden eagles were eating them?
Yeah. So historically, golden eagles have been around the Channel Islands.
I'm looking up golden eagles because they sound like they have to be really big to be able to eat a fox.
They're big. Well, but also remember, these are small foxes.
Yeah, but they have teeth.
Yeah, well, these guys have big talons and sharp
beaks.
Oh, they're
huge.
Yeah, they're big birds.
Oh, wow.
We have them here in like L.A. Well, not quite in L.A. They don't really like urban areas, but in Southern California.
Yeah, I feel like around the new house, because it's kind of by Griffith and it's in the hills, I see birds of prey flying. But
oh,
I think
you totally see red-tailed hawks.
I think it's mostly hawks. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. But there's a lot. It's kind of cool.
They're researchers who track the golden eagles, and like you see them like... come right up to development and stop. Like they do not like, even though like they're birds, they could fly over.
Yeah,
they don't like.
But they don't want to.
But so what happened was, there used to be a lot of bald eagles on the islands, and then when we basically sprayed our entire planet with DDT, the bald eagles really suffered.
Did you see that bald eagle try attack Donald
Trump?
Yes,
I did.
He's a he's pissed about the DDT.
So the bald eagles, the absence of the bald eagles made room for golden eagles to move in.
Gotcha.
But it wasn't just that, because golden eagles need food, right?
Mm-hmm.
And on some of these islands, like Santa Cruz in particular, like on almost all the Channel Islands, you had invasive goats and pigs and things like that.
Okay.
On Santa Cruz in particular, you had all these pigs. Mm-hmm. The pigs were small enough to be picked off by the golden eagles.
Yeah, it says here that golden eagles eat like big, like hares, rabbits, marmots, and
yeah. So they're not going after like the invasive deer necessarily. It's certainly not the bison on Catalina Island,
unless they're really small, maybe.
But the pigs,
teeny, tiny baby,
maybe. Yeah. But the pigs can be taken by golden eagles. So the absence of the bald eagles plus the presence of the pigs mm-hmm. has meant that the foxes are on those three northern islands are now also subject to predation by the golden eagles.
Yeah.
And these are foxes that have no natural predators. They had not evolved.
Because so
the
no
bald
idea
eagles
what to do.
Don't
yeah.
go after the bald eagles don't go after foxes.
Yeah.
So
if they're going to get eaten, they're going to get eaten because they have no defenses.
Right. Right. Yeah. And it's interesting. And the same reason why they so easily get run over by cars, right? Because
they don't know
they're not
better.
Evolved for
yeah.
them.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that around the same time that the foxes on Catalina were being hit by CDV, the foxes in the Northern Islands were being hit by golden eagles.
Mm-hmm.
So all the different islands are managed by different institutions and organizations, but they've all worked together on this fox problem.
So who were you there with?
I was there with, so Catalina Island, mm-hmm. 88% of the island is owned and managed by the Catalina Island Conservancy.
Okay. So kind of like the Galapagos in that way. They have their own, like, team of people.
Yeah.
Really
yeah.
take over most of it.
Yeah. So there is Channel Isles National Park.
Mm-hmm.
Catalina is not part of that.
Okay.
So NPS manages some of the islands.
National Park Service?
Yeah. The Nature Conservancy helps to administer one of the islands. That's part of the national park. The U.S. military administers a couple of the islands.
And what were you there when you were with the Channel Islands Conservancy? What were you there doing? Were they just doing health checks? Were they...
Okay, yeah. So now that the captive breeding program is over, they're doing monitoring.
Okay, so the captive breeding program is done. Now they're just trying to make sure that they're healthy and that
yeah.
they're... Okay.
Yeah. So for 6 weeks every year, they do trapping. And they run different trap lines all over Catalina Island. Over the course of those 6 weeks.
And you knew that that was coming up.
Yeah, yeah. And I did a bison story about the Catalina Island bison.
Hence
a few
the
years ago.
Animal contraception
right.
book.
And I knew about the foxes.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to my contacts there, I was like, I really want to do a fox story. Like when it's fox season, you know, yeah. when it's fox trapping season, let me know. I'll come back out. And I like missed it last year because I was out of town. So I was finally around and.
And how do they tag them? Is it an ear tag? Is it a collar?
So they,
is it an
so
ankle thing?
They trap them in a regular little mammal trap.
Mm-hmm.
They bait them with some like cat food or something. But they get a microchip, the same one that you put in your like pet dog.
Oh, okay. Like the little grain of rice looking thing?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a little bit longer than a grain of rice. I have a picture of it.
Mm-hmm.
They're passive. They're called pit tags, passive integrated transponders.
Yeah, because you only know where they are if you can
if
like
if you scan them.
Yeah, like yeah. at the supermarket.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. They give it an ID, and then when they trap it, they can scan it and see if it's one they've trapped before.
Mm-hmm.
They can, you know, they know who that individual is, and if it's one they hadn't tagged yet, then it got a tag. Most of them, they all got a blood draw.
Just see if they were carrying any of these viruses.
So the blood. The red blood cells can be used for genetic analyses.
Okay.
The blood serum, once they separate it out, can be used to tell. So they vaccinate them for CDV mm-hmm. still, and they vaccinate them for rabies. So the blood serum can tell them things about how those vaccines are working.
It's so crazy that like in a small enough population like this, these ecologists can actually care for the foxes
yeah.
the same way you would care for your house pet.
I mean, it's a living laboratory, right?
Yeah.
Islands are really special.
Yeah.
And so they get the blood draw, they get the two vaccines. Some of them, though, especially if they're slightly older males, don't get the vaccines. Instead, they get a radio collar that actually actively transmits.
Mm-hmm.
And those are called disease sentinels because if they die or when they die, then the signal from their collar will change. And they fly a plane over the island every week to look for the handful yeah. of animals that are collared. And if they find one that has died, they can go do a necropsy. And then they can discover if there's a new disease spreading through the island they don't know about.
Right, because if everybody's vaccinated, then you don't know where the virus population is.
Right, or a different virus,
yeah.
new virus. So they do that for some of them.
So are they bitey? Are foxes
no,
very
I mean,
bitey?
I mean, they like I said, they don't have a natural history of predation, really.
Uh-huh.
So they're pretty curious.
Okay.
But like, you know, if you're a fox and you've been in a trap for a couple hours, and they're such strict regulations like how long an animal can be in a trap.
Gotcha.
Like, that's why you start very early, because they would go in the trap at night probably. Mm-hmm. So you start like before the sun is up, and you try to do it as quickly as you can.
How many did they trap that day that you were out there?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, there were three biologists working different trap lines. I was with one of them. We kind of
like dozens.
Dozens, yeah.
Yeah.
We probably, I mean, I couldn't tell you offhand. With the researcher I was with, we probably worked up like 5 or 6, and we went a little bit slow because we were like talking and I was reporting and taking pictures.
And the one that she put in your, like, you were sitting on the ground and she put one kind of in your lap, to hold.
Yeah.
Was it young?
One was, I think that was one of the ones who got a radio collar.
Oh, so
it was probably a year or two.
Okay.
Maybe more than a year, maybe 2 or 3 years.
Were you afraid it was going to bite you?
No. I mean, for one thing, I've handled animals before, so I kind of know how to hold them, and mm-hmm. she was telling me how to hold it. But yeah, like to get them out of the trap, you know, she has like a empty glove that she mm-hmm. uses so they can bite onto it, and then she can take it out by the scruff.
Gotcha.
Right? Yeah, so they're... He was totally chill. I mean, like, the needle that puts the microchip in, like, you know, between their shoulder blades,
mm-hmm.
Like, that, I would not want that. Like, it's a...
Yeah, I'm sure that they get a little...
And this, like, it didn't even whimper. I mean, and that's, like, a wildlife thing. If you're a wild animal, like, and you're not feeling well or something hurts, like, you're probably not going to show evidence of it.
Mm-hmm. But also probably these researchers have been doing it for so long that they're very
absolutely.
Good at it.
And do it very quickly.
I took my dog to the vet the other day, to this new vet that I've been seeing, and he did a blood draw, a stool, and took his rectal temperature. And my dog was like wagging his tail.
Yeah.
Like, it was crazy. He didn't feel anything. Oh, and he gave him 3 vaccines.
Yeah.
And he didn't feel any of the needles because this guy was just good. Like, I don't know. He knew how to pinch it.
Yeah,
my dog was happy.
So, like, it got all these little injections in the blood test, and it didn't. It gets a little eye covering.
Okay,
but it calms down.
Yeah, that helps.
But
with a lot of animals, that helps.
Yeah, like when she gave it to me before we went to just release it. We, you know, here, go be free.
Yeah.
And it just chilled in my lap for a minute or two, and then I like put it down on the side of the road,
mm-hmm.
and it just scampered off into the brush and like stopped and turned around and looked at us, and then just kept scampering off.
I think it's fascinating when you think about foxes. Like, I'm not sure if we have enough time to like fully get into it, but anybody who hasn't read up on the, what are they called? The silver foxes? The ones in Russia?
In Russia, yeah.
Yeah, that
Siberia.
That were bred to become domesticated. But we forget about the other side of the experiment where they were actually breeding the aggressive ones to be more aggressive. And it's really interesting to see what kind of a first generation fox was like, and then what the domesticated ones, their ears fold over, their tails get floppy, all of the things that you see, spots come out. But then the super aggressive ones are like, holy fucking shit, look at that animal.
They're monsters, yeah.
They're monsters. And it's really interesting how much, I mean, it's that age-old question, but how much like genetics and then a combination with environmental cues can actively affect the personality of an animal or a human being.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, we really are subject to what our DNA says, and we're really subject to the environment that we grow up in.
Yeah, well, and these were foxes that were explicitly bred for these things, right? It wasn't like by accident or random.
No, yeah, that was the really interesting thing, is that these foxes were like wild caught foxes that then generation.
Well,
they were
fur farm foxes.
Oh, from the beginning they were fur farmed.
Yeah, that part of the deal with this experiment. This is one of my favorite experiments in all of science. Is this researcher at the time? It was Soviet Union. It was USSR.
Mm-hmm.
Oh
yeah, I guess they did make like.
And it was illegal. It was illegal to like believe in Mendelian inheritance, or like to do research that like was
reinforced that
right.
Yeah.
Like Lysenkoism was there was this like a guy. His name was Trofim Lysenko. Basically, what he advocated was like a version of Lamarckian inheritance.
Yeah.
And it had to do with mostly he wrote about agriculture and like plants and stuff.
Okay.
But if you were a biologist and you were not on board, you were like killed or, you know,
so fucked up.
Sent off to somewhere.
So basically, if you were a biologist who had observed the way things actually are and reported on it,
right,
you were like a heretic.
So this one researcher, very smart guy, his name was Dmitry Belyaev.
Mm-hmm.
I don't quite know how to pronounce his last name.
Yeah, it was close enough.
He was a biologist, and he was interested in questions about, like, he looked at wolves and he looked at dogs, and he, like, at that time people knew that dogs came from wolves, mm-hmm. but they didn't quite know how. And he went to Siberia to work for the Institute of Cytology and Genetics in a little town on the Trans-Siberian Highway called Novosibirsk. Under the guise of, like, the idea, so the thing about those foxes is they could only breed once a year.
Just
so
because
you could
that's
only,
their biology.
Right.
Okay.
So you could only get fur foxes. You could only get new fur
once
a year.
Gotcha.
So his job was to try to figure out if he could breed foxes to breed more times a year.
I see.
Under the guise of studying basically fur production, he did this research on domestication.
Yeah.
And his study is still ongoing now. I mean,
and was he
dead.
When he first started this, was the hypothesis that if you breed the tame foxes, you will eventually get a dog-like creature? Or was he like, I have no idea, but what would happen if we took the two extremes and just bred them?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't, you know, the things that I can read mm-hmm. are, like, I don't read Russian, right? There's
some early
papers. Most of the stuff that I've read about it, like, the person carrying on the research now, her name is Ludmila Trut, and she's Russian. But she's published things in English.
Mm-hmm.
There was a and the truth is, there's only a handful of things that have been, like, published about them.
But there are, like,
scientific,
like,
papers.
But there is also, like, documentary footage, which
is
great.
PBS Nova did an episode called Dogs Decoded. It was one of the first times that, like, a film crew was in at the
at the
breeding center in Novosibirsk. I'm dying to go. So there are some researchers at Cornell who collaborate with them, mostly, like, doing genetic stuff. But what he realized, like, he wondered if, rather than selecting for, like, he noticed that there were, like you said, all these anatomical, physiological changes that happen in domestication.
Yeah.
The
pictures are stunning.
Yeah.
Looking at the difference, like, I'm just kind of turning the screen so that you can see. You know this already,
yeah.
But, like, I'm assuming even the very first, if you just Google silver fox experiment, the first image under Google image, I'm assuming, without even reading about it, that looks like a fox that was bred to be aggressive.
Well, not necessarily.
Or a fox that wasn't
not necessarily.
Bred. This is definitely
because the thing
a
is they got
fox.
Multiple coat colors. Like, that was the
interesting. But this is definitely this fox would never occur
yeah,
in nature.
I mean.
It's like it's we, spotted.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So,
like, spots
so
don't occur in nature.
Basically, instead of selecting for, you know, like, floppy ears and curly tails and
mm-hmm.
fewer vertebrae and weaker bones and all these things that domestic animals have when you compare them to their wild counterparts,
uh-huh.
he wondered if when you selected them on the basis of behavior,
gotcha.
Those things followed. And that is what happens. So he would go up to a fox. It was a very simple, like, assessment. And he'd stick out his hand, and if it approached, right, like mm-hmm. animals have a fight or flight, right? Or really it's like a fight, flight, or faint response. And if it would, like, approach, then those foxes got to breed with each other.
Yeah.
And if it would, like, back away or act a little bit aggressive, then those foxes got to breed with each other. The ones who couldn't quite be assessed became fur coats.
I see. oh yeah, I forgot. He still had people
yeah,
who he needed
yeah.
to give fur coats
yeah.
to.
Yeah, and that's kind of how the research was funded in the early years.
That's interesting.
And eventually, you know, within I believe it was by the eighth generation.
Mm-hmm.
I used to teach this study when I was, you know, teaching.
Yeah, you remember all the names really well.
I'm a little bit obsessed with this study. I think it was by the eighth generation he started to see, even though he was only selecting on the basis of behavior. This basic approach avoidance
that's
dichotomy.
When he saw the morphological changes.
He started seeing these changes in anatomy and physiology. And eventually, you know, this, like I said, this experiment is still ongoing. And he, by the way, he didn't just try foxes. He also tried, like, minks and stuff. Foxes just happened to be the best.
Like it didn't work as well with minks?
Yeah.
I
think there are probably some animals that are more domesticable.
I think dogs are.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
There's a reason Canids. That we have dogs. Dogs, horses, pigs.
Cows.
Yeah, there's
chickens.
A reason for it.
Yeah. Yeah, so...
Gosh, look at this picture of the aggressive.
So there actually is a common molecular pathway. Yeah, they're like dragons.
They're so scary. Yeah. They're like dragons.
Yeah, that's actually what she says in the documentary. She says,
really?
She calls them dragons? She says this, well, through the translator. She says something like, this is no fox, this is a dragon.
This first picture is a wild fox and a domestic fox.
Yeah.
It's so crazy.
Yeah.
Left, wild, silver fox, right. But you're right. This may have just been wild. It might not have been bred to be aggressive.
Yeah.
But I guess in nature, the silver foxes tend to have dark faces and dark ears. This is so amazing.
It's so cool, right?
Yeah, they end up with floppy ears, yeah. Short tails. They physically start wagging their tails. Like behaviorally, they wag their tails.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So it's like...
Lick your face.
Something about these physiological changes are like sharing alleles. They're in the same place.
It has to do with the stress response.
Okay.
Right? The stress response is what governs this approach or avoid response. And it turns out that it shares a common molecular pathway. Like, in the stress response, you have adrenaline, right?
Yeah.
I'm reaching back into my
adrenaline. You have cortisol. There's like some things
But adrenaline shares a biochemical pathway with melanin.
Oh, interesting.
Which helps to explain why you get the changes in coat color.
Because if you're less stressed throughout your life, then you can express I don't know.
So basically what happens is these are animals, right? Remember pedomorphism, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Domestic animals tend to look like juvenile animals.
Yeah, their eyes are bigger.
It's as if they're locked into an earlier stage of development. So all infant foxes are going to be a little bit the same. And these domestic ones, like it's like they don't grow up, right? So it's almost like their development has been slowed down. And you can actually look during the embryonic development of these foxes and look at the movement of neurons and things, and you see that in the domestic foxes, these things move slower.
Interesting.
So in these domestic foxes, which with the different coat coloration, for example, those melanin molecules have not quite gotten all the way to where they're supposed to go.
Wow.
Right?
So it's really just halting that development.
And you look at the ears, like those molecules in the ears that are supposed to help the ear stick up have not quite developed all the way, which is why they're a little bit floppy.
Because baby fox ears are a little bit floppy.
Right. So, I mean, that's a little bit of the super simplified, I'm not a biochemist.
But it does seem to be the case that we often forget that, with traditional meiosis, right? And you've got the you've got germline cells that are made, and then those germline cells recombine. We often think about genes being like, okay, this gene is specifically located on this portion of this chromosome, and then sometimes we'll talk about, well, what would happen if I, cross that gene or I change that gene, and we forget that there are other genes that come along with it.
Yeah, that's exactly. It's called a selective sweep.
And so sometimes specific things, you breed for specific things and you get stuck with other things, which is why a lot of domestic dogs have like fucked up problems.
Because they're overbred.
Yeah, they're overbred. And lots of times the things that we select for that look really cute also come with hip dysplasia.
Right.
And you don't even know it. Like, why would those two things be on in the same place? But they are. They like share a locus.
Right. They could be, yeah.
So that's interesting. So it's like this, there's like a multi-tiered approach to why these foxes became dogs. They became fox dogs.
We can't because they're still elite. They're still classified as exotic in California, and you cannot own an exotic pet in California. But there are places. I years ago I was trying to pitch a story, and I talked to a woman in Michigan who had adopted one of these. They're expensive, but you can buy them as a pet. The domestic ones, obviously.
Do you think that they make good pets?
They say that they in the marketing of them. They say that they have the loyalty of a dog, but like the independence of a cat.
How funny. Look, I just saw a picture. I just looked up a picture of a domestic silver fox and he's like playing with the tennis ball.
Yeah.
you can look
up on YouTube and look at videos of pet fox, domestic fox. There's a lot of people in Europe who have them.
Yeah.
I don't think it's like a few in the US.
I mean, I'm not sure how I feel about it.
Me, they're domestic. They're just like dogs.
It doesn't matter. You're right. I think it's more about sometimes a decision that in a vacuum is a good decision can have
widespread
effects.
The same problems I would have with someone who's like, oh my God, I want a fox. I would have a problem if they wanted a dog too, if they weren't responsible pet owners.
That's true.
You know?
But also sometimes, but
if you're going to have a fox, you can't live in an apartment.
No.
Like, they're not, they're, they are domesticated, but they're not dogs.
But also,
like, they need a lot of space.
Sometimes the same kind of person that might want a fox because it's really cute and whatever maybe it's not so much that the person themselves wouldn't be good at having a dog, even though that's true, but other people aren't educated about the situation. It could spread to irresponsible ownership of other types of exotic animals.
There are probably
animals.
Questions about what kind of a role model you're being, maybe.
I'm definitely interested in what an exotic animal is in LA. I've never looked into that because I know people who is a sugar glider exotic? Is a hedgehog exotic?
Anything that's not a domestic.
So like anything but like a
dogs,
cat, a dog,
cats,
and a parakeet.
Rabbits.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, like there are many places where you can't have chickens. Right?
Yeah. I just met a lady who has chickens in her backyard.
As you know, there are many places where you can't have bees.
But now you can in
now
LA.
You can in LA.
Woohoo. And you added some fresh honey from a beekeeper to your
delicious.
Was it? You liked it?
Yeah.
So good. I want to keep bees.
So yeah, like normal animals, like the animals we think of as normal animals that you can own.
I know a lot of people who have exotic pets. Though.
And it's so bad.
I know. But we have friends who have exotic pets.
Do we? Yeah.
We have friends who have snakes.
Yeah. Yeah. Snakes. So I read an interesting argument recently about reptiles. I'm not entirely convinced, but I'm more convinced than I was, that having reptiles is not having a pet. It's like having a hobby. It's like
interesting.
Have,
like keeping bees is not having
a
pet either.
It's like you have a snake the same way you might raise orchids.
But they're alive. I mean, orchids are alive too.
I agree.
They have the feels.
Like, so that doesn't necessarily get at the animal welfare question.
Yeah.
It certainly gets at the why would you want to have a snake question? You can't cuddle it.
For
me, I don't get it.
We've talked about that before. I full on agree. Like, I do not understand having a pet that's not, like, soft.
You know? Let me say something about foxes. Those are soft. Like, and then you're like, oh, sure, fur coats. I get it.
Oh, yeah, obviously.
Right. But, like, I've touched... I'm not a person who like has this intense need to touch animals the way some people do, mm-hmm. but through the course of my work, I've gotten to touch some cool animals, right? And usually, like you feel their fur and it's like coarse.
Yeah, a lot of animals have hair,
like big cats, for example.
They're never as soft as they look.
But these foxes, man,
cuddly.
They were soft.
So wait, how do you feel then? Gosh, we're going so over, but I have to know. How do you feel about fur? I think that's such a complicated question where it's hard for me to just immediately say like fur is bad.
I think it's complicated. My usual like party line is that I think about fur the same way I think about diamonds, which is that like if it's an heirloom, if it's like old.
Oh really? So it's not even like leather for you?
No,
like because you're okay with leather, right? If it's like responsibly sourced.
Yeah, I mean, it's to me that's not so different from a hamburger. Right, like
it is not different from a hamburger. It's true.
And I eat hamburgers.
So it's more about a personal line in the sand.
And animals from which we get fur are typically not domesticates.
Gotcha.
Even if they're like...
Oh, because cows are technically domesticated.
Yeah, they're domesticated.
But foxes, for example...
Are not.
Even if it's
been farmed. They may be farmed.
Yeah.
But they're still wild animals. Like they're genetically... They're wild animals.
Are there any... Rabbits? What about rabbit fur? Rabbits can be domesticated.
I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because they're also...
So for me, it's like if it's old and it already exists, that's more fine than a new one.
Sure.
But there's also questions about what kind of a role model you're being. Like, where are you wearing it and who's going to see it? Are kids going to see it? You know?
Interesting. Because also, I've struggled with this a little bit lately. Not that I live in LA, so I don't have to wear fur. But you struggle with it
because it doesn't get cold.
It never gets cold. Yeah. But you struggle with it as a person who is like... keeps up with fashion and who's really into like certain types of trends. And like, I love leather, which is rough. It's like a definitive fashion trend for me. I really like leather. I also eat hamburgers, but I also have been struggling with that feeling lately. Fur, I've never owned fur, but I definitely have been at stores where I'm like, pretty. But then, you know, I've never purchased it.
Yeah.
A kid, we had like the little, the fox feet or whatever.
I remember rabbit's feet.
Rabbit's feet. They weren't fox feet. They were rabbit feet. And you would have them on your keychain or something like that.
Although
totally
I assume
normal.
Most of those were synthetic. Like
probably. But it's also fucking weird now that I think about
real
it.
Rabbits.
Like, why did we have rabbit feet?
Yeah.
That's weird.
And people think it's weird that I have some like dead animal parts in my house.
I do too. I get it.
Yeah, but yours are like art. Mine are like things I've found or like from my reporting trips.
And like I remember having a Davy Crockett like raccoon hat when I was a little kid.
Yeah, but that can't be real.
You don't think so?
I mean, I'm sure there were some.
I was in Texas.
But like, well, maybe, okay, maybe in Texas they were real.
I was like, I'm Texas, pretty sure it was
Texas,
real.
Like, they'll kill anything.
But that's the weird thing. It's like, it's things like that are such a part of the culture that you don't stop and think about it. Like, right. Conscientiousness is a muscle you have to flex, right? Yeah. Because you can, I just spit all over the microphone.
That's why it's got a spit guard.
Yeah, that's what that is.
Windscreen.
Slash windscreen. That's really what it's for. They could probably hear that when I was cleaning it off.
I could hear that.
Okay. So yeah, you don't think conscientiousness is a muscle you have to flex. You can't.
Yeah. Well, and also goes to the question of thinking about animals as individuals or as like stock. Like, it's interesting that in so many cases we use the same words to describe animals as to describe like agriculture.
Well, because,
like harvest.
Well, because for so long, especially agriculture, like husbandry type animals.
That's
how the laws are written too. That's why we don't have like welfare laws specifically for farm animals typically.
Yeah. I have almost the opposite problem. I can't believe I'm going to tell this story. my friends make fun of me for this. Once when I was giving a lecture to undergrads as a grad student, I was talking about domestication and like breeding and stuff. And I used the phrase breeding stock when I was talking about human mating. Because to me, humans are just other animals.
We are.
Like, I have the opposite problem.
Yeah. No, but we are. Yeah, and
I don't know. I don't know if it's really a problem. It's just a problem sometimes using certain vocabulary.
It's maybe a problem for, like, I don't know, like getting a date.
Like, look, someone for me, if she's not down with the work that I do and the way that I think about the world.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But yeah, I could. It's I love it though. I can always tell when somebody's going to be a good friend of mine by the way that they like describe things. That they always have like a slightly different and scientifically informed view. You hear it in like the words people choose and in the phrases that they
use.
True. Anybody who really knows how to use the phrase significantly or statistically significant, I think I'm like, oh yeah, tell me more.
Or anecdotal.
Anecdotal, exactly. Oh, that just happened on a text thread today.
Yeah.
We had some.
Oh, I think I said, wait, someone said that.
No, like one person said, was concerned because they found a dead hummingbird. And then one other person said, oh my gosh, I saw a dead hummingbird too. And everybody started trying to guess, is it because of the Santa Ana winds? Is it the and then I was like, maybe it's just a coincidence.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Oh yeah. And she was like, are you a skeptic? Like, yeah. But yeah, we have to think about those kinds of things.
Yeah, that's true.
My friends are such nerds. All of our friends, I'm saying my friends to the people listening, you know that you have nerdy friends when every other day you get something on a group text that's like, can you identify this insect?
Yeah, that's true.
Or this plant?
And then the response is like, well, I think this, but maybe this. And like, where were you? And what time of day was it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think today I was like, well, it looks like an Allen's hummingbird. But like those are here, so I can't believe they're not adapted to the Santa Ana winds.
You did say that. You were like, they evolved here. Like, I don't know why they wouldn't be adapted. And they're like, oh yeah, that's true.
Like sometimes animals just die.
Exactly. Maybe you just have
to. In fact, quite often.
Two dead animals in a day. It's not that crazy. All right. I'm running out of steam. What about you?
Was this tea caffeinated? I mean, I'm fine.
No, I think that's just. I think that's just like an herbal like.
Well, that's not even tea then. It's just like flavored water.
That's all tea is.
Except tea has caffeine in it.
Some tea has caffeine in it.
Herbal tea is not tea.
But wait, didn't
it's not made of tea? Tea is an actual like plant. Made of flowers.
Didn't you get coffee on the way to pick me up to go
I
to dinner?
No, I didn't end up because we were going to go to dinner
and then you
podcasting
didn't,
first.
You're right. And then you didn't end up getting anything caffeinated at dinner.
That's true,
like,
but I'm still wide
cokes.
Awake. Talking about domestication and like ecology, island ecology, man.
Gets you excited.
That does.
You have to drive. Well, actually, it's not that bad this late at night. You just have to watch out for palm fronds all over the road. The fuck?
I guess.
Right outside my door, there's like... It looks like a bomb went off, a palm tree
bomb.
It
looks like there was a palm tree fight is what it looks like.
It does.
Like there was like a palm tree murder.
I cannot wait to move and not have a giant palm tree right over my door. When I was trying to sleep last night, all I could hear was like crazy palm fronds crashing.
It wasn't so windy on the west side. Or I just didn't notice.
It was bad here. Yesterday was bad in general. Like I did
a
shoot
yesterday.
I'm a freelancer,
so I don't leave my house.
Yeah. I actually weirdly was moving around Elijah because I did a shoot in the Santa Monica Mountains about pumas in the morning. And then I came to Mar
Vista.
It's
interesting that you say pumas. I call them mountain lions.
Everybody calls them mountain lions. Even the researchers call them mountain
lions. Right. I explicitly don't call them cougars because I don't need the laughs.
Yeah, that's true because the cougars of LA and Is that what you mean by the laugh?
I mean, I use it when I want a laugh.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
normally I just call them mountain lions.
I think the reason I call them pumas is because they're named
P-22.
P-whatever. Yeah. They're named for the fact that, because puma is the species, but mountain lion is colloquially.
No.
It's not.
The species is Puma concolor.
Yeah.
It's a genus.
It's the genus. Sorry. Yeah. But, yeah. Puma's the genus. But then
mountain lions are actually this animal, whatever you want to call them, is the animal, the species with the greatest number of common names in the world.
And also
puma, panther, cougar, mountain lion.
Panther, you're right, because in Florida they call panther. Them. And that's what one of the researchers I was interviewing yesterday morning was saying. I was like, what's the, and he was like, there literally is no difference. I mean, there are regional differences, but he was like, it's all about like where you live, what you call it.
Florida panthers.
Florida panthers. In the Southwest, people call them, or the West Coast, people often call them mountain lions. But if you go farther north, they call them pumas.
Cougars,
And then I think they call them cougars in Texas. And,
really?
Yeah, like in the Southwest, they call them. When I was in school, my high school, Clark, we were the Cougars. But then
That was your mascot.
That was our mascot. Oh. And then Plano East, we were the Panthers.
We were the Wildcats.
Oh, so we're all the same. No, but isn't that weird? We're the Clark Cougars, then the Plano East Panthers. Same thing.
Same thing.
I don't think any of us knew that. Because obviously in the pictures, the Clark Cougars were always brown and the Plano East Panthers were always black.
Really?
That's how we always showed them.
And I don't think... Are there Black Panthers?
There are Black Panthers.
Yeah.
That's like the name of a African-American.
Right. I hear Panther and I think of the Pink Panther.
I could see that.
Like, I don't think of a mountain lion when I hear the word Panther.
When I put Black Panther into Google Images search, there's a lot of Panthers. I always think of this.
Mm.
Like a jet black cat when I think of
like
a panther.
Like Jungle Book.
Like Jungle Book, exactly. Let me see if I put a mountain lion, what it looks like.
It'll be P-22 is what it'll be. It'll be a mountain lion under a Hollywood sign.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that one's on a snowy... Wait, I'm going to put in panther because I put in Black Panther that time. And just see... Yeah, look, when you put in panther, it's almost always black.
Interesting.
Isn't that weird? I've always made that association in my mind.
I would love to see a black jaguar.
Oh, that'd be gorgeous. Are they black in the Amazon?
I mean, there's a black morph. They're very rare.
Yeah.
Mostly they look like jaguars.
When you put in puma, you see the same thing as when you put in mountain lion.
I bet.
Yeah.
I mean, they're the same. So.
They are the same, but for whatever reason, when you put in panther, you only see the black one.
Interesting.
It's very strange. But I think most people think of these as being different animals.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to put in cougar now.
But they're not. Oh, no.
They're not. They're all the same.
They do have safe search off or on.
No, it's all animal for like many pages.
Oh, good.
And then it gets into women.
That's heartening.
It is. It's good. Oh, my God. They're so cute. And you're right. This is fascinating. When you look at them as babies, even the cougars as babies, they're spotted.
Yep. And they have those bright blue eyes.
And they have bright blue eyes. So there is a different differentiation of melanin in their fur. And it changes as they get older.
Yeah.
Oh, they're so cute.
Well, and cats actually develop differently than canids. Like
do they?
Yeah. I'm about to
geek out hard.
Really nerdy on you.
I can't wait. I think it's great to end the show with something extra nerdy because we were talking about like TV and steak for a really long time at the beginning.
So cats grow proportionately. Like a big cat, like an adult cat, let's say even domestic cat, lion. Mountain lion, jaguar, you know, whatever, lynx. An adult version is a larger version of the juvenile.
Oh, right? So juveniles don't have big bobbleheads.
They grow proportionately.
Okay.
Because
most juvenile animals are bobbleheads.
Well, it depends how they grow. So canids and primates, by the way.
Maybe when I say most, I'm talking about animals like us.
So canids and primates and some other species grow allometrically. So different parts of the body develop in different rates.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting because if you look at those animals that are domesticated, on average, most of them, at least domesticated the way we're talking about domesticated.
Yeah.
I don't think domestic cats are really domesticated. Not in the same way.
Yeah. No, they're not. They're totally not.
Yeah.
They're assholes.
Yeah. Well, they're more like commensals. They're not quite domesticated.
Gotcha.
So they grow allometrically. Like, there is a way to be juvenilized. Like, you can't be a juvenilized cat, because adult cats are, they're just bigger. They're just bigger.
But kittens are
cuter.
Does that make sense? It totally makes sense. But kittens are cuter, but it must be other reasons.
And it's not, you know, it's not as if, like, it's not 100% hard and fast rule. Like,
and also, it's not just the change in growth, right? The big face, big eyes that contributes to pedomorphism. It's also like softer fur. And it's a lot of different things. I remember reading, is this true? I want to look it up first.
Baby cats are just smaller big cats.
Is it true that a human baby's eyes are the same size? It's not. They're smaller.
As
an adult's eyes. They're smaller. They're just not as much smaller as everything else.
The head has to grow less than the rest of your body does.
Yeah. Right? Exactly.
Right. But, so, like, that's what I mean. Like, we grow allometrically.
So an infant's eyes are between 65% and 75% of their adult size.
Right. Whereas your torso is like, 8%?
Yeah, it's like a fraction. It's like really small. So, and that's one of those big, when we talk about pedomorphism, that's a big part of it. It's having big, sad eyes.
And that big forehead.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, like, if you look at domestic dogs and you compare them to, like, a wolf, let's say, adult domestic dogs have that same big forehead.
Oh, for sure.
And in part is because of the way the skull grows and changes, and the snout gets bigger and longer and shorter. And domestic dogs have shorter snouts with bigger foreheads. You know, cats don't have.
They're brachycephalic, bradycephalic. Yeah, which one is it?
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm looking it up. I like being able to use big words periodically in context, but we can talk about them.
Isn't
a lot.
Like your whole thing on SGU about like. Jargon.
Oh yeah, I hate jargon, but I love it when you can introduce a really fun word in context and talk about it for a while.
Yeah,
brachycephalic.
Right.
Having a relatively broad, short skull.
Right.
Usually with the breadth at least 80% of the length.
Right. So think of like a pug, right?
Oh, that's
their
like
faces are smashed in, but they still have big foreheads.
Yeah, that's the extreme of brachycephaly right there.
And if you look at primates, so this is why I think domestication is really interesting, because I think that basically like humans are domesticated versions of ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Except the weird thing is we are the ones who domesticated ourselves.
Yeah, we're self-domesticated. And there are people who argue that dogs also self-domesticated in a way.
Or that dogs in some ways contributed to our domestication.
Maybe to our cultural.
More to like the pre kind of our ability to move more into an agrarian kind of change.
Could be.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of things that had to happen for that.
But dogs
more
are
than just
epic.
Dogs.
Dogs are pretty much.
I know
the
you
greatest
like dogs.
Ever. I love dogs. I want to give them credit where credit's due. Okay?
I mean, I think the domestication of certain like plants had more to do with it.
Probably, I think that is the definition of agriculture.
Yes,
domesticating plants.
But yeah, like if you look at hominid skull, like earlier hominid
that's
skulls,
true.
Like, human skulls, like you see some of those same kinds of changes.
Yeah, pronounced jaws, pronounced ocular ridges,
and we have. Much bigger foreheads, but like shorter skulls, like
flatter faces.
Our faces are a little more punched in.
Yeah.
And many of the same, like, you know, you watch the news and you'd believe that humans are like the most destructive, worst, most aggressive species on the planet. And like, in some ways we are, but in many
ways, because we're awesome with tools.
Right. In many ways, like we are quite like tame, like quite peaceful.
Well, we're incredibly cooperative.
Cooperative.
Yeah.
The same way that domestic dogs are.
Yeah, that's the number one. I remember doing a piece on domestication, and I remember the researcher saying that over and over. Like, the number one reason that dogs make such domesticates is because they're social.
Yeah.
It has everything to do with sociability. Yeah. And humans are arguably the most social organism
on the planet.
And even
if you just compare, like, bonobos and chimpanzees, right? And, like, there's a lot of, you know, we talk about how bonobos, are the hippie apes, and they solve everything with sex. But it's not that they don't have aggression.
Yeah, but they don't like fucking.
They don't go to war.
They don't have aggression the way chimps do.
Yeah,
yeah.
So, and if you look at them, like there are some of those like signatures of domestication, those physiological anatomical distinctions. You also see when you compare even just bonobos to chimpanzees.
Interesting. Are they more upright?
I don't.
Or maybe their faces are a little bit flatter. So. I can't really tell the difference between a bonobo and a chimp, except they're a little smaller.
They're a little smaller. Their faces look a little different.
They
but
are
smaller.
Different.
Is also one of the
yeah,
like more gracile bones, longer limbs.
Because I think if I just looked at a picture on the internet with no context, I wouldn't be able to tell you if it was a chimp or a bonobo. But if you put them side by side.
Bonobo's face is a little bit darker. I mean, on average.
Yeah. They are, though. They're much smaller.
Yeah.
And
they used to be called the pygmy chimp.
They're also one of the only species, like humans, that has sex facing each other.
Yeah.
Very rare in the animal kingdom to, like, look
bonobos
at each other.
Well, I'm dying to go to, I mean, DRC is not the safest place to go. The only place in the world where they are in the wild.
Yeah.
But they also have, it's also a place to see Okapi, one of the few places to see wild Okapi.
That's cool. I was just talking about those the other day.
Really?
Yeah.
Most people don't even know what Okapi is.
Unless I'm mixing it up with another, and it's the weird looking like zebra giraffe, right? Yeah. It's actually more like a giraffe, but it's striped like a zebra.
Its bottom half looks like a zebra, and its top half looks like a giraffe.
But I think it's related it's more to
genetically
a giraffe.
It's closely to, yeah.
Yeah. But it looks like a zebra giraffe. Yeah. They're freaking awesome. Yeah. I was literally just talking about that yesterday with my producer.
It's so random.
Because the name of his production company is like Okapi Pictures or something like that. Yeah. That's so weird. Okay. We've been talking for too long. We have to go. Before we go, though, you've already answered the last two questions. We don't have to do that again. I want to have you as a repeat guest like all the time.
Sure.
Cool. I locked him in, you guys. Before we go, though, tell people how they can totally bug you about all of the things that we told them they have to tweet you about.
Yes, that is welcomed. JGold85 on both Twitter and Instagram. I think when I was on last, I did not have Instagram yet.
I probably didn't.
I was like episode 8.
You were early, yeah.
JGold85 on those things. Facebook.com/Jason.Goldman. You can find me on Google+. I guess.
And so if they want to read, because you write for so many, like just do a quick list of the different publications.
I mean, the
best
thing to do is to like add me on Facebook, like my fan page, or Twitter or whatever. But I pretty regularly, I write 2 pieces a week for Conservation Magazine's blog.
Mm-hmm.
I write quite a bit for Scientific American for the print magazine. I've started doing some Scientific American 60-second science podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
You can find me every once in a while at Audubon Magazine, at Hakai Magazine, Earth Touch News.
And historically...
Los Angeles Magazine, which is pretty cool, in print.
Yeah, that's great. But historically, you've also written for like Slate.
I've written for Slate a few times.
BBC.
Thank you. I write for BBC Future.
Yeah, you still do.
Quite a bit. And BBC Earth every once in a while.
For IO9 before.
I founded and edited their animals website, and that was about 9 or 10 months.
Gotcha. Okay. So you've probably, if you're into this arena, you've read Jason's work, but now like pay attention to the byline.
Yeah. Bylines are good. But yeah, like my entire collected works outside of my blogs,
mm-hmm.
my science blogs blog, my Scientific American blog, and my IO9 blog, all of the links to everything I've ever written is on my personal website, jasongoldman.com.
jasongoldman.com. All right. Well, jasongoldman.com. Thank you for coming on the show. Thank you for eating steak with me.
Anytime.
Everybody listening, thank you so much for coming back week after week. I'm looking forward to the next time we get together to talk nerdy.